This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, my name is Nicholas Morgan. I'm an editor at Ahval News, and this is Turkey Abroad. Joining me today is Dr. Baskin Oran. He is a professor emeritus at Ankara University, where he is also an expert on nationalism and minorities in Turkey. And he has written a new book on this topic. Dr. Oran, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Nicholas.
So, in terms of your new book, what would you like to tell us about it? If you can give us a brief summary of what you have written in this new volume.
Yes, I think it would be good to start with a summary of the book. The name of the book is Minorities and Minority Rights in Turkey, from the Ottoman Empire to the present state of the Republic of Turkey. This book represents the zenith of my studies on minorities that I follow since 1974. It builds on my previous book in Turkish, Ethnic and Religious Minorities. This is it, a rather large book. This book we are talking about today in English is both an abbreviated and, in a sense, more detailed version of the second. The reason for abbreviated is that I have removed all general information that the interested reader might find in other books. In regard to detail, I have provided more information on minorities in the Ottoman Empire and in the Republic of Turkey that the same reader could not find collected in one single book, in a way updated till the end of 2020. Mm-hmm. Now, chapter one is named a conceptual framework, where main concepts used in the book are displayed. Let's start with the definition of minority. A minority must be different from the majority in many ways, race, color, religion, whatever. Two, must be numerically inferior. Three, must be non-dominant, because in South African Republic, apartheid regime, whites were only 20% and they were not minority, believe me. Four, must be a citizen, not a foreigner, because a foreigner is a foreigner, not a minority. And five, must have a self-consciousness of being and staying different. That means assimilated people do not count as minority. Now, there are two sorts of states for a minority, a host state and a kin state. Kin state, let's not go into details. The host state is where the minority lives. It can be a national state or a nation state. Many people believe that these two terms are identical. Not at all. National state dated to 1789, the French Revolution, establishes the nation as the source of sovereignty, as opposed to God or king. While nation state imposes the identity of the reigning ethno-religious group as the supra-identity of the whole nation and rejects and suppresses all other identities. Therefore, a nation state can, one, try to assimilate the minority. Assimilate means dissolve the particular characteristics of the minority within the majority. Or, for groups that the nation state considers as impossible to assimilate, or that it does not wish to assimilate because of racism, etc., try to eliminate the minority by two ways. One, ethno-religious cleansing, in many ways, genocide, deportation, exile, expulsion, forced exchange. Two, compelling the minority to disappear, physically disappear, by applying physical attacks and discrimination. Now, this is the first chapter. Chapter 2 deals with minorities in the Ottoman Empire. The chapter explains the Ottoman millet system. Millet means, in Arabic and in Ottoman Turkish, religious community. It was made up of two asymmetric elements. One, those who rule and judge, the Muslims. Two, those who were ruled, dominated, judged, the non-Muslims. This second category enjoyed a significant degree of bestowed non-territorial autonomy and self-governance in their own affairs, but was subject to significant restrictions and regulations. To sum up, this second category was definitely second class in the millet system. This chapter, second chapter, studies the situation of Ottoman minorities left in the Balkans when the empire started to decline at the beginning of the 18th century, and how the notion of minority protection that emerged in 16th century Western Europe resonated in the Ottoman Empire through, one, capitulations extended to some European countries, two, the bilateral and collective protection treaties imposed by major European powers to protect Christian minorities in the empire, and three, rules of the first international organization, the League of Nations, that was born in 1920. Chapter 3 deals with minorities in the Republic of Turkey. The Republic of Turkey was born in 1923. This is, to say shortly, a map of minorities in Turkey. I begin by distinguishing between non-Muslims, whose rights are recognized by the Turkish state, and two, those who are not recognized, that is to say, Muslim ethnic groups. Officially recognized minorities are the Armenians, the Jews, and the Rum Greeks, and to a certain degree, the Syriacs or Assyrians. Other non-Muslims are ignored by the state. Baha'is, Yazidis, Protestants, Jehovah's Witnesses, and the Levantines. Muslim minorities who are accepted as minority according to international standards, but not by the Turkish state, are the Arabs, the Alevis, the Kurds, people who migrated from Balkans, and those who migrated from the Caucasus, and also the Roma people, Gypsies. Chapter 4 deals with Turkey's obligations under international law. Here we distinguish between the era of League of Nations and the era of United Nations. League of Nations is important, the era important, because that's when, in 1923, the Treaty of Lausanne was made with the major powers, and it recognizes, this treaty recognizes, between Article 37 and 44, non-Muslims as minorities. But let me say right away, this treaty falls behind the international standards today. Do I have to add that Lausanne does not recognize Muslims as minorities? During the United Nations era, Turkey is a signatory to many human rights and minority rights conventions, Council of Europe, Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, etc., but numerous reservations. Chapter 5 deals with minorities in Turkey's laws and legal set structures. I'm not happy to say, but the underlying goals of the various governments appear to be erasure, ethno-religious cleansing of non-Muslims and assimilation of Muslim groups, in particular Kurds. In this chapter, I present the current legal structures, laws, etc., and formulations that sustain such policies by focusing on the main branches of the government. First, legislative and executive powers, and then the judiciary, the Constitutional Court, Court of Cassation. For instance, the Constitutional Court closed Kurdish political parties. The Court of Cassation treated non-Muslim citizens as foreigners, called them foreigners. Chapter 6 deals with legislative reforms in the period 2001-2004, and resistance to it, and reversals after that. Between, as I said, 2001 and 4, eight European Union harmonization packages were enacted in a view to enter the EU. During this period of some 3 years or so, thanks to the rulings of the European Court of Human Rights, many improvements took place concerning the non-Muslims, giving them their rights concerning their foundations, their immovable property, and the Kurds. Radio TV broadcasts were permitted, and the Alevis. But the situation of the Kurds, in particular, worsened after July 2016, when the Gulen movement, by the way, Gulen is a priest who is right now in the United States. The Gulen movement, the Islamist ally of the Islamist President Erdogan, made a failed coup. After the failed coup that the President Erdogan welcomed as this is a God-given opportunity, trustees were appointed to dislodge elected mayors in Kurdish areas, and all TV and radio channels were closed in Kurdish. After this, Turkey came to be governed by emergency situation, statutory and presidential decrees that violated every single human right, and this situation still continues at the very moment. There have been, let me just give you a few figures. There have been 511,000 detentions, 30,821 arrests, 38,578 discharges concerning the Interior Ministry alone. Just think of the rest of the country. Tens of thousands of students and 6,081 academics from 117 universities were dismissed by statutory decrees with no recourse to the judiciary. Right now. You won't believe this, but even MPs in the parliament are unable to enjoy freedom of expression. Using terms such as Kurdistan or Armenian genocide in the parliament can be used as the grounds for suspension from parliamentary sessions or to be discharged, to be charged by monetary fines. There have been 26,115 lawsuits filed against committing the quote-unquote crime of insulting the president, and 9,556 persons are convicted for that quote-unquote crime, while the leader of the party in power and the President Erdogan openly insults civil rights defenders and even the party leaders. As I was among these civil rights defenders that he insulted, I personally filed two suits against the president and his interior minister, but the courts decided that it was freedom of speech. Right now, let alone freedom of speech, right now, even freedom of thought is violated, because even MPs are taken to court for not objecting while listening to a certain speech. Can you imagine that? Someone makes a speech, you listen to it. When the speech is finished, you get up and go home, and you are taken to court for not objecting against the speech. Chapter 7 is entitled The Ideological Foundations of Repression and Discrimination. The Hanafi Sunni Muslim Turk mentality. This is the supra-identity based on the historical millet system, appears in different forms. On the subject of nation, oneness and unity are regarded as the same thing. In this extreme unifying, of course, quote-unquote, approach, all kinds of differences are viewed as dangerous, and those that are viewed as threatening the dominance of the Hanafi Sunni Muslim Turk supremacy are considered existential threats. Any such differences are rejected, prohibited, and punished. Thus, any talk of minorities, of their legal struggles or rights, is framed as dangerous efforts to undermine the indivisibility of the country. On the brink of the 21st century, I would say, even when the country was going through a deliberate reform process that I mentioned above, some people and institutions in Turkey strove to ensure that Turk, an identity based on blood, Muslim Turk, remained as the supra-identity in contradistinction to Türkiye'li, which means from the land of Turkey, a territorial identity. These people resisted reforms using what the Turkish American social psychology professor Vamik Volkan called chosen trauma. Chosen trauma is a notion that human groups stick together around shared pains as much as shared victories. And pain, Professor Volkan taught us, generating the feeling and expression of victimhood is in fact maybe the stronger social adhesive. This holy fear is what we call the Sevr syndrome. Sevr is the treaty that partitioned the Ottoman Empire in 1920, Sever syndrome, as a military Sever paranoia. These people say Turkey will disintegrate like in 1918 if people are allowed rights. Now, the common ideology of the ruling Islamist party, AKP, and its ally, Nationalist Movement Party, is based on this paranoia, and it is called the Turkish Islamic Synthesis. Finally, the last chapter, the implications of persistent rights violations. The basic approach of the nation state is minorities upset the cohesion of the state and of the nation. And what are the outcomes of this basic approach? One, obstruction of democracy. Two, division and polarization of the nation. Three, damaging Turkey's international prestige and status. That's it.
You know, you provide this really useful overview into just the situation across many different areas related to minority rights inside of Turkey today, and it just really shows how much that this topic has been interwoven into the background of at least modern Turkey since its founding in 1923. And there's quite a few areas I'd like to really just start with in unpacking. And the first one is towards the end of the Ottoman period and the secularization that followed as the country began to consolidate. Why is it that even after the empire and
sorry, I didn't catch the last word.
Oh, I was saying that. Why is it that even after the end of the empire and the formation of the Turkish Republic in 1923, despite all the changes in the meantime, whether it was the international treaty obligations or reform processes, that the treatment of minorities
and secularization, you mean?
Yeah, secularization. Yes. And why is it that the treatment of minorities, whether they were religious and ethnic, continue to remain so unequal, even close to 100 years after the Republic's founding? What would you say on that one?
You see, Nick, all nation states abhor minorities. The only identity they respect is the identity of the dominant religious group. The group, as I said. During the empire, non-Muslim minorities were better off because it was an empire. An empire is a congregation that leaves alone its subjects as far as language, religion, denomination, etc. goes. It's a fact that they were considered second class during the Ottoman Empire. During the Republic of Turkey, the non-Muslims are not only considered second class, but a fifth column also. Therefore, they were better off during the empire. They are not so well off during the Republic, although, as you said, there has been a secularization of 100 years.
And, you know, of course, Turkey still remains quite a diverse country, whether these minority groups are recognized or not all the time inside of it under the law. And, you know, it does bring to question, though, how the process of assimilation in my mind and what that really looks like today. I mean, take the immediate example that comes to my mind, of course, is with the issues the government has persistently had when it comes to the country's Kurdish people, and how they have of course a very distinct identity and language within the Turkish state that has, of course, been caused a lot of the friction in the last several decades or so. But on this topic, what has the current Turkish government stance really been on these ongoing problems? Like, is it possible for the Kurds to be more assimilated into the state at this point, or what do you think that would look like?
Do you think I should start with non-Muslim minorities and come to the Kurds afterwards?
Sure, please.
When we refer to non-Muslim minorities, of course, they almost disappeared. For instance, at the start of the Republic in 1923, there were 120,000 rooms, Greeks. Now they are at 2,000 only. On the other hand, no state can assimilate a minority of a different religion, because all over the world, and especially in the Middle East and the Balkans, the most important element of national identity, national quote unquote, is not language or race, but religion and even denomination. Therefore, non-Muslim minorities in Turkey could not be assimilated. That's why the nation state always wanted to get rid of them. When we refer to Kurds, there is nothing that the nation state can do more about them because of a reason that I call chronological rule. Let me explain this chronological rule. If in a given country, the national economic market means when you manufacture something in California, you sell it in New York. And when you manufacture something in New York, you sell it in California for almost the same price or whatever. And you find it always in both places. This is the national economic market. If in a given country, the national economic market is set up before the minority develops a consciousness, this minority has little chance, because the national market unavoidably leads to natural assimilation. This is what happened in the United States. But if, on the contrary, a minority develops a consciousness before the state sets up a national economic market, this consciousness cannot be overcome. The efforts of the nation state to suppress this consciousness will only make it stronger, this consciousness. And this is exactly the case of Turkey. National economic market developed after mid-1980s, while Kurdish consciousness developed at the beginning of the 60s at the latest.
Aside from the Kurds, there's another group that really just kind of comes to mind that I think is worth mentioning too. And it would be the situation related to the Syrian refugees that are now outside the country. In the last 10 years, Turkey's become host to over 3 million Syrians, and of course the majority of them are themselves Muslims, and many of them have also struggled to really they have, of course, protection status. They're considered guests within the country, but then many of them have also managed to encountered a lot of difficulty when it comes to becoming citizens themselves. What do you make about that situation? What are the complications there for, say, a Muslim refugee group primarily and assimilating into Turkey, especially since we've seen a lot of that friction so far, whether it was through hate crimes being directed against them, or just increasing discontent towards their presence inside the country and being consistently scapegoated for any number of problems. What do you think there?
Over 4 million, Nick. We know, there is a distinction between minorities and foreigners in this discourse. I'm sorry. We know that foreigner or citizen, if a person is of the same religion with the majority, there is much less problem for the state. This situation of the Syrians is quite new, but given that they are overwhelmingly Sunni Muslim, Sunni is as important as Muslim, they will probably be assimilated in time. Right now, of course, Turkey is in a very bad shape economically and in every sense. There is a lot of hate speech and even crimes against Syrians. But in the middle run or long run, they will, if they stay, they will be assimilated because they are Sunni Muslim.
And you also mentioned in one of the chapters in your book how Turkey is a party to quite a number of international treaties and conventions related to minority rights. And you also mentioned that it has always had reservations about a number of these conventions. Does this have to do with how you described the state, the way in which the state conceived itself and its views on minorities, like the in terms of the minorities that are a part of the countries, and then there are those who they can consider foreigners? What are these what are some more of these reservations that Turkey's had?
There are especially two reservations. One says the rights that I give to these people, so and so, cannot be against my constitution. And two, they cannot be against the stipulations of the Treaty of Lausanne. The constitution that these reservations talk about is made by the coup d'etat of 1980. Therefore, it is a constitution that does not really care about personal freedom and rights. And secondly, it cannot be against the stipulations of the Treaty of Lausanne, which was made in 1923. As I said above, this treaty is surpassed by the new rights and freedoms that we should have enjoyed since 1990s. Therefore, this reservations takes with one hand what Turkey has given with the other.
One of the concepts that you also mentioned that I thought was personally very interesting was this idea of chosen trauma. And just to take that a bit further into the present, how has this notion really just changed during the 2 decades or so now of Erdogan and his AKP's rule inside of Turkey? How has this chosen trauma for his followers and the president himself really just taken shape? What does it look like?
The funny thing is, Nick, there was no there was no chosen tribe or anything like that when the Republic was proclaimed in 1923. This started in 1990s when people start to ask for more rights. Now, to come back, to start from the concept itself, countries and peoples that need cohesion look for and use a chosen tribe. For instance, it's genocide for Armenians, and for Turks, it's Sèvres Treaty that partitioned the empire in 1920. It is very important that Erdogan's chosen trauma is Kemalist reforms, because they brought secularism and oppressed Islamists. Now, I concede that oppression was some kind of normal during the first years of the Republic in 1920s. And let's not forget, in 1920s and 1930s, whole Europe, the democratic Europe that we know of, was infested with fascism, Nazism. From west to the east, from Portugal to Turkey. As I say, oppression was normal during the first years, because a revolution from above took place. A revolution from above means my internal dynamics are lazy. They do not permit me to get developed, to get modernized. Therefore, I take the laws of the democratic countries and apply them to get modernized. And this is called revolution from above. This is what Kemal Atatürk had done in 1920s, especially. But during all my studies and readings, I came to discover an iron rule, I would call, concerning this kind of revolution that intends to bring modernization and to underdeveloped countries. It's a rifle that can be fired only once in order to trigger lazy internal dynamics. If you try to fire it more than once, the rifle explodes on your face. Kemalist officers tried to refire it in 1960, in 1971, in 1980, and in 1997, and the rifle now exploded to our face, and it's called Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
And you also mentioned, of course, that the original chosen trauma during the Kemalist era was Sev syndrome, and of course that's still discussed a lot today among many analysts and observers of Turkey. But in this time where we see a lot of deep polarization inside Turkey, a weakening of the institutions, economic problems, and there are certainly a number of other problems that we can probably slap in there too. Is it possible that for all of this fear of having its domestic issues with minorities exploited by any outsider, that the state almost locks itself into something of a self-fulfilling prophecy, where it's undermining itself from within by denying greater rights and democratic participation to these groups, and ultimately just engaging in more of this divide and rule form of politics?
Well, it is true that Turkey is extremely polarized right now, that the Turkey's institutions, every institution of Turkey, is on the way to go to trash. and of course, in the midst of economic problems. What you say is totally logical, but Erdogan is not in a position to use logic for the moment. He's in a total panic. Just give you one example. Which leader talks about going to the moon while there is an awful economic depression and even hunger in his country and a pandemic on top of that? This is nothing but panic.
Yeah, and unfortunately at that point, it just can really seem, it just begs a lot of questions on, you know, what really comes next. Through his rule, and the moon project obviously isn't going to be saving the country, and these issues have a lot of these issues with minorities have predated, of course, Erdogan too. So you know, it still remains an open question on how any of them could be solved. If you had any last thoughts on what can be done going forward,
what can be done?
Yes. Yes.
Right now, there is nothing to do because the opposition is unbelievable. There is no opposition except the Kurdish party, and they are now
under a lot of
going to either close the Kurdish party or put in prison their MPs.
Mm-hmm.
It's more difficult to do the first one because AKP, Erdogan's party, made it very difficult for the Constitutional Court to close parties because his own party was about to be closed at the moment. But there is nothing to keep them away from putting to prison the MPs of the Kurdish party.
And of course, that's something they've already done with Selatan.
They've already done it with a couple of them already. I have a strong hope for the coming, for the near future. The exaggerations of Erdogan himself. This is what is going to destroy that one-man system. Mm. Nothing else. Because there is no opposition. Coherent opposition. But I believe in Erdogan and his extravagances. That's all I can say.
Dr. Arun, it was a real pleasure to have you on to hear about this topic and to learn more about your new book. I really look forward to it becoming available on my end here in the U.S. I believe that's in March over Amazon for everyone who's listening and interested in the book. So when it comes out, I look forward to it. And I also really look forward to any opportunity to speak again in the future with you.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you very much. Thanks for the opportunity.
My name is Nicholas Morgan, and this is Turkey Abroad.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.